here on my left side. Wolfgang Lucht and Dominik Bestre will converse on limits of knowledge. What are the limits of observing, of accuracy, measuring, and calculating? What are the limits of descriptive accounts when it comes to the abundant scope of the Anthropocene? This is the overarching topic of this conversation. Wolfgang Lucht is co-chair of Earth System Analysis, one of the four research domains of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. His work addresses the future of the biosphere, the effects of climate and land use change on global landscapes, the interaction between human societies and the Earth's environment. Dominik Bestre is physicist and historian of science. His research focuses on the history of scientific and technological practices and more broadly on the social and political history of the science. He's currently professor at École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris.
My personal history is that I was interested in the Earth and in humans from an early age. I've always had this interest as a juvenile already into the details of scientific findings about the history of Earth and these things. And then I came into puberty and I was sidetracked. I became attracted by these nuclear physicists who did all these cool stuff like writing a lot of math equations on the blackboard. Mm-hmm. And so at that phase, I went to studying physics. And then I was too lazy to be as good, I would have had to work much harder. And so I did physics, and I never regretted it. But later, I really went back to my real love, which is the Earth System Sciences, with the viewpoint of a physicist. And I've not regretted any of that. And otherwise, I'm a professor of geography now. So enough sustainability science.
Now we have parallel stories because I also started as a physicist, mm-hmm. even if before I was more interested in history than in physics. But mm-hmm. I did also physics and mathematics. And finally, like you, I found that not exactly what I wanted to do. So I came back to history, really. And so I started another mm-hmm. cursus in history. And I've done mainly what was told, kind of social, political history of mm-hmm. science, what it means to do science in context, in fact. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so much interested in what the knowledge says as such, but yeah. how it happens to say that. In which context it appeared obvious that that was the thing to say.
Okay. That's what so I'm there about. Seems to be something very seductive about physics.
Yes.
But in the end, since we are talking about the limits of knowledge, I find that journey into the limits of knowledge concerning the Earth, our planet, something that really excited me from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because I feel we have a short life, and to be able to witness our environment, our planet, our Earth, I always felt that this is a special privilege to have some time to study that. And so for me, those journeys to the limits of knowledge about the planet are like the limits, going to the limits of the Earth in exploration voyages. You know, I feel like the limits is where, you know, interesting new things happen.
Yeah. No, for me, I touch also a lot the question of the limits of knowledge, but I mm-hmm. touch that in a more general way because as an historian doing a lot of philosophy, I would say, I've written a lot on that, but of course, the obvious starting point is that no form of human knowledge can exist without limits. That's obvious. Yes. I mean, we cannot discuss that really at length. Mm. So the problem is, could we, according to the field to which at which we look, Could we show that the limits are not of the same nature? I mean, and even in connection with the Anthropocene in general, for me, a major point is when you, for example, in your case, when you do modeling, mm-hmm. you have certain form of uncertainties and limits.
Yes.
If you do, if now you work on the dimension of chemicals in the environment, mm-hmm. It's completely different to do epidemiology or to do pollution of a river, for example. So so that's what interests me most. I mean, in which way we could map differences. So perhaps in your case, what do you see in your particular work? What do you see as the major dimension of limits or uncertainties or...
Well, I can tell you what our ambition is in a domain where the limits of knowledge really play a crucial role. And that is that we are trying basically to build a model of the whole of the Earth system. Not because we think that a model can ever depict a complex thing like the Earth system, but because we think it's good as a tool to think about certain things. You know, I do believe that there are many forms of knowledge and many approaches to knowledge production also. Mm-hmm. And the natural scientific way where you treat things as objects and you try to formalize them and generalize them, that's one particular mode of doing it, and by far not the only one that produces meaningful insights. But we have learned from history that there's a certain predictive power in some of the things that have been created there. I mean, after all, Einstein concluded the theory of relativity before there were really empirical evidences for it. They came later. So that's a pretty amazing thing that this is possible. Because for the first time in human history, maybe there are some fields of knowledge where we can kind of take things that haven't happened yet into account, not just react to things that are happening, but actually have a certain foresight in things that don't just follow from regularity or from practice and getting acquainted with things, but where actually can predict things that are not obvious from everyday being. So when I say we are trying to build a model of the Earth, a computer model, in the vein of the day, then this is not because we think that this is the core of the knowledge, but it allows us to think about things in a certain way. Now, the computer model we want to build is one that doesn't exist right now, which has the physical and chemical environment of the planet and the ecology of the planet and the human societies. So then we're dealing with three very different things that have a very different nature of knowledge and a different predictability. And this is where we struggle with it. Because I think in physics and in chemistry, basically we know the basic laws. And the problems we have is limitations of data, limitations of complexity. We don't have good theories of the macro behavior of complex systems. Mm-hmm. But we do think we have most of the basic laws we need for that, like fluid dynamics for the atmospheric motions. In ecology, there is no theory of ecology. We have parts of it, evolutionary theory, some chemical aspects, but there's no total theory of ecology, and who knows if it even exists. So that's already becoming a little bit more difficult in terms of predictive powers. There's huge gaps in knowledge. And then if you want to model the macro behavior, the average behavior of human societies, some would even doubt that that's even possible, that there is a macro theory of human societies. So the question is, what aspects do we think we can actually model in a formalized manner? What is the collective behavior that we think we can get away with modeling some trends of those so that there's some predictive power to that? And that's a very much an open question, but it's clear that those three domains are different. But if you want to do a model really of the dynamics of the whole Earth under human influence, we would need a model with all these three components with very different foundations and predictabilities and limits of knowledge. Not just limits, but also structural differences in the structure of the challenges that probably cannot be resolved at all or quickly.
Yes. Listening to you, I remember that, of course, we cannot have, I would say physics is something easy. Because it's
the short,
easiest part. Limited. Chemistry of the atmosphere, you could also, it's a little more complicated, but you could follow that. But at the moment you introduce economic behavior of complex actors and political decision and so on, obviously you cannot model that, we all agree. It doesn't mean it has, qualitative knowledge could be very useful. I mean, it's the way we describe, if you take in anthropology, it's a very interesting kind of knowledge, even if it is not formalized.
Yes.
But I do not know, for example, in detail how in the IPCC reports, how the various groups work together. You could tell me some things about that or not, because it's...
What do you mean by working together?
I mean, the report finishes at the end with some political form of recommendations.
Yes.
So, I suppose at every level, new kind of knowledge are introduced. You could start with the physics of the atmosphere. Mm. you have the satellites giving information, you have nodes, you have the network, mm-hmm. you could put that, you could normalize your data, put that in the model, have it run, you could have various models built by different mm-hmm. people, compare the result. We could see that, okay?
And for this is happening, yeah.
Yeah, and but then if you start entering the data by people behavior, consumption of oil, emission of carbon, mm-hmm. and then you could add more than that. I mean, what are the economic logics? Mm-hmm. Because companies are running according to their own norms. They are not following physics laws. They follow market laws. Mm-hmm. They follow the battle for their own interests. How that could be modeled in the IPCC and so on to get up to certain results?
Well, I think in the IPCC, the focus is not really on the limits of knowledge. I mean, they acknowledge in the IPCC because everything is qualified by the certainty that this community feels certain statements have. But the IPCC really is about focusing on those parts that we think we do know, either with high or with lower confidence. And I think one really has, when we think about understanding the world, understanding the meaning of things, of course, then we have a huge ocean of lack of knowledge and of different forms of even approaching those fields. But at the same time, in a period now when the planet is changing rapidly, and there's some real dangers in that as far as we can tell, in a world like the IPCC, the focus is really much on focusing on those maybe very partial aspects, but those that we think we have a quite high confidence that our predictive powers are good enough to feel quite certain that, you know, at least in the next decades, this will probably not be completely wrong. And that's the result of many decades of constructive work. And the message is just in that, you know, they're not comprehensive, they might have some uncertainties, but those things that we do know, I mean, they could be really important now. And there's a feeling in that community to which I also belong that this knowledge should not be wasted by questioning too much all the epistemological backgrounds, a discussion that is really important and crucial at the same time, but that should not distract from the situation that according to our best scientific production now, there are certain things that you disregard at your own peril, like the connection between CO2 emissions and the temperature rise. Mm. Do you feel that is an unjustified assumption from a historical perspective?
No, not at all. I mean, science is no doubt a great endeavor. I mean, so we have in one way or another mm-hmm. to take that into account. Okay, so I know a situation in which it's more complicated because, if I take something I know better than this kind of field, if I take chemistry, for mm-hmm. example, so no doubt chemistry is a great science. It's the biggest one, most important number of people, most important quantity of capital, and so mm-hmm. on. So, okay, and no doubt chemistry has changed drastically our lives over the last two centuries, I would say, from the production of soda and acids in 1800 up to now. But what we know is that whatever you do in chemistry, in a way, you never really anticipate the effects.
Yes.
What is striking in chemistry is that what interests chemists is what you will do with the new molecules you devise. So you devise molecules, you try to understand what you could do with them, and you put them most of the time on market without any study, apart for pharmaceuticals, in which at least since half a century, probably not more than that, you have to prove at least that some negative effects are controlled. Well, it's never total and so on. But for most of the molecules produced by chemists, the number of molecules produced each year, it's several dozen, thousand every year. And basically, we know nothing about the effects. So, for example, I'm quite sure of that. I mean, what we know in terms of precise effects of molecules probably concerns some hundreds, molecules, perhaps 1,000 or 2,000, not more. For the other 100,000 molecules, we know nothing. But we go on producing.
So that's what you said. Physics is simple. It's a simple problem. So the climate change problem, probably we have some control over, you know, state of our knowledge. Chemistry, obviously, is very difficult. Ecology is probably even more difficult. And then we talk about the world of human thought. So, but what do we do now in a situation where we're transforming the planet, where the Anthropocene is unfolding, and we're trying to make some sort of sense? You know, it's a discussion between us humans about where do we draw, what do we build our actions upon, and what type of thing should we take into account, and which...
Yes, but there we start encountering the difficulties. I mean, we could agree quite easily up to now. Then it will become more complicated. This afternoon, I was in the room for the previous session, and there were a discussion about who is the we. We should protect the planet, we should care about the Anthropocene trend, and so on. And also the problem is, who is we? And then, for example, if I take chemistry again, I mean, chemistry, it's most chemists are working in industry. They also are working in industrial contexts in general. And so who is the we in chemistry? In chemistry, it's mainly making molecules. And I say it again, those molecules are tremendously good, interesting, useful, no doubt. But since every molecule we produce, it might have effects we do not control, the problem is, for example, in this case, the we should be chemists, chemical industry, chemists in the laboratory, but more than that, I mean, people leading chemical industry, Monsanto. Mm-hmm. Who is the boss on Monsanto? He is a major element in the we. If we do not find a way to integrate those people in our reflection, it might be limited. I mean, I know another case.
I think it's very true what you say, but on the other hand, one should not go so far to say that, for instance, the connection between CO2 emissions and temperature increase is a product just of the we of the atmospheric physicists, because the temperature increase will happen for all people. It will not be, if the discourse goes other ways, it's a question of whether you have that knowledge or not. And it sounds like a very positivistic position, which is not meant to be in that way. But at the same time, I think there are certain things where predictability just seems quite likely, or the fact that you can trust the predictions to a certain extent. And those are the ones where then suddenly you have a responsibility, I think, to not overemphasize the alternatives, the limits of knowledge and the relativity of knowledge, because there are also some things where it's just irresponsible to disregard it. And that's a tension we are under right now in the global change debate, that some things we know what it means and how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where we get to the problems. So that's why I said the IPCC, I think, is an enterprise of focusing on those things that we feel confident we know about and that have a certain predictive potential. Mm-hmm. And that's different from things where we cannot predict things.
Yes, okay.
Because there are forms of knowledge. For example, I'm very attracted by alchemistic traditions. Before the modern sciences appeared, there were strong alchemistic traditions. And if you kind of interpret it very to the depth, basically they felt that knowledge is produced by close encounters. You have to embed yourself. You have to be in close contact with your object. You have to fuse with your object. You have to be immersed in it in order to get to know it and then derive knowledge from that, which is just the opposite from the modern natural sciences, where you kind of put the object, you remove yourself from the object, you have it on the laboratory table. So it's very different propositions about, you know, what your relationship should be to something in order to study it. So that objectivation and that personal sensual experience. And the last big German thinker in that direction was Goethe, who was, you know, trying to construct scientific knowledge from this immersion experience. But whether the alchemistic tradition that I find very convincing has a predictive power in the sense of the modern rational sciences is another question. I think it probably is more meaningful even for human existence. But here we're talking about the temperature change of the planet, for example, or some toxic chemicals and its consequences. And there I think the predictive aspect of knowledge becomes important.
No, I mean, perhaps there is a misunderstanding as in any conversation. So, yes, I mean, you have predicted power, and that is done since two centuries at least. I mean, you know that you could imagine, I don't know if you know that, but for example, in 18th century, in the colonies mainly, a lot of people started to worry about the anthropic effects that the colonization had on climate. Yeah. I don't know if you know that. I mean, it was absolutely a lot of, for example, if you take Humboldt, when Humboldt came back from Latin America, so it's very early 19th century, he had seen several places in which lakes were disappearing, which was becoming dry, and he connected that with the fact that trees had been cut probably too much, and as many studies were done like that at the time, and as a consequence, for example, in many countries, in France, south of France, for example, it was enormous. I mean, you had replantation of a lot of trees. And it was done because of erosion and so on, but also for climate change. Yeah. I mean, you had up to the probably 1870, something like that.
Yeah, there were even some theories that certain things you do to the land improve climate so that you could make more hostile lands arable and things like that. There were all sorts of ideas around.
Yes. And in the same way, if you take pollution, chemical pollutions, I mean, early in the 19th century again, you had a very clear conscience of that. I mean, they know what they're doing, and anyway, they go on doing it. So that's my point. I mean, we could predict, which is fine. Okay, and I think that at that moment we have two questions that perhaps we could discuss quickly. Mm-hmm. One is, should we believe that guy? You said it's predictable. Mm-hmm. Fine, you are convinced of that, you. Okay, how do you deal with the fact that other people might not be, particularly because experts in general disagree? The rule is not that experts agree, experts disagree, that's the rule. And I don't know, for example, you know, of course, you cannot not know that our former Minister of Education, Allègre, which is a climate sceptic, and I mean, I've heard him, I mean, he was absolutely a nasty guy in a way, because with a lot of syllogism, like, for example, I mean, models are never sure. That we will agree, a model is a representation that necessarily has weaknesses in many ways. Okay, it's a simplification. So if models are not sure, we should not believe them. He more or less explicitly said things like that, you know. So so the question is, I think in a way, since certain sciences, certain kind of knowledge could be built, which is predictive and anticipates negative effects, for example. It could be in chemistry, it could be in nuclear business, it could be in, at a more general level of the atmosphere and the climate warming. But now the question is, how do we see the question of trust in the public space? We need absolutely to discuss that, because if we do not discuss that, we will have a very nice we thing. We should, but the we should doesn't matter if we do not have the means to understand if it could succeed, expanding, being trusted, being believed. Yes. Okay. So, so for me, it's you have various dimensions to that. You have the fact that experts disagree. So we have to, I mean, it's interesting around your topics. You might have 99% of the expert in the field say something, and 0.5% says the contrary. But if when you are in a media space, I suppose you agree with that, the media will say we need one representative of each. At a certain level, you could say, okay, what is the meaning of that? I mean, it's 99% and 0.5%. Perhaps we should take a kind of democratic majority vote, I mean, or something like that. But at the other extreme, you have also, of course, the sheer manipulation, in a way, Allègre.
I think this matter of trust is really, really crucial in these things, and it really comes back to this question of what is the role of science in an open society. And what is the role of science in that project of enlightenment? What's the position of rational modern sciences in the project of enlightenment? Because obviously we know all these things about the dictatorship of, you know, the objective truths that are supposed to be discovered. And today we have this problem that the carriers of such knowledge are just a few, and nobody else can judge whether they are right. And I personally tend to think that the climate scientists have a good cause for claiming what they claim, while personally I'm very skeptical against what I hear about from nuclear physicists or from genetic manipulation scientists. It's a problem I quarrel with. I want to tend, you know, people should believe us climate scientists, but I understand completely the skepticism in some other fields. So this is a major problem, and it all comes down to the question, what is the social position and the social role? And, you know, it has to do with the trust, but also with a certain culture. Of what is the position of that scientific system within general society? Are they experts that were delegated by society to produce certain things that society thinks would be valuable to it? Or is it a secret group of, you know, high priests who have some secret knowledge that nobody else can understand anyhow, you know, like modern physicists with string theory and so on, where nobody can really even check whether the computations are right? So how do we want to deal with this situation? And I think this is something that I would want to give back to society. At this point, then I would not say, like, you should do this, you should do that, but I would ask, okay, what do you want to base your knowledge on? You can base it on astrology, you can base it on poetry, you can base it on science if you feel it's a useful technique. Yes, and so that's where I would like to start that discussion. Yes, and I think it has to do with this whole discussion about the role of public education, the role of funding of science, why do we fund science at all in the beginning? And there's a certain culture of having a critical distance to what scientists do and at the same time employing them in a useful manner in society. Including those who are just given freedom to work on whatever they want, because you never know what they might find. Yep. So that's why I think the trust thing is not just a question of, you know, can society now trust our experts, but there's a whole relationship going on, and I think it's broken today. And maybe it has to do with the modern media world, but I think it's also just a cultural thing, whether you value this particular form of knowledge production. And I think the only reason to value it at least as much as some other forms that we have that are also very valuable is because of its predictive power that I think can be demonstrated to, in some cases, in particular problems, is larger than some other forms of knowledge production that might produce a lot of meaning but don't have that predictive power. So they're more interpretative, they give more context, and they give more meaning to life. As science, I mean, you know, once I go home, I do all sorts of things that are not scientific because they give me much more pleasure than science itself. But at the same time, there's something about science that I think we lose at our own peril. And I would give that question back to society. You know, what do you want to base your decisions upon? And then maybe people feel re-empowered to actually say, okay, I actually am willing to kind of give you a sort of benefit of the doubt for a bit.
Now, I understand what you say, and I, in a way, I understand you as more practicing scientist than I am now, because I'm really an historian and sociologist. And, I understand, but so basically, you have an image of, you have science and you have society. Science talk to you. Do you believe we say something important? And if not, it's a matter of, I don't know, culture or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's too abstract a picture. In reality, if you allow me to describe how I see the situation, you will see that might be too simple. First, you do not have science. Because as we said, Allègre is a scientist. I mean, who would doubt Allègre not to be a scientist? He is. Okay? So anyway, science never, on the concrete questions that are important for societies, problem with global warming, problem with nuclear waste, problem with chemical product, and so on. The list could be endless. On those questions, scientists disagree.
No, I don't think that's a true statement.
In this case, I need 2 or 3 minutes to justify.
Yeah, it depends
position.
On the question. In some cases, you're right, but in others, there's no disagreement. It's not like everything is controversial. Science builds a body of knowledge, and a lot of that is agreed, and at some point, it might be revolutionized and toppled, but it's not like everything is controversial in science. That's the whole point about science, to reach some sort of progress.
But the points we are discussing at the moment are not science. They are technological development or... effects on in your case about the atmosphere or something like that, in the case of chemical about the health of population.
But it's not technical, the question whether CO2 increases global temperatures, which is what your minister seems to doubt, and you said, but he is a scientist, I think he's a politician. Those are not things that are completely controversial. So maybe that's a bad example. I mean, there are many other things, I think, probably with nuclear waste treatment. I mean, there's probably much more disagreement. Obviously, you can buy your experts if you want to. I mean, I'm not saying that science is a clear-cut thing, but there are some things. That's what I meant with, I think there are huge oceans. If you talk about the Anthropocene, I think there are huge oceans of uncertainties, of limits of knowledge. You know, how should we deal with it? What is our innovative capacity? What is our ability to produce shocks culturally? Can it bring us forward or will it throw us back? Will it go sideways? These are all things that it's basically, we have very little knowledge and the future will tell. But some things I think we do know. And it would be, I think it would be dangerous, actually, I use this word very carefully, to kind of undermine that by claiming that everything is uncertain, which probably you didn't mean to say.
It's not my point. I'm not saying everything is uncertain. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying everything is certain.
Yeah.
I'm saying, since we were talking about trust and society, mm-hmm. that in society, okay, for mm-hmm. in nearly all contexts, what is in many contexts, mm-hmm. I'm saying people, scientists, technicians, engineers, experts disagree. I'm not saying it's false. I mean, Allègre, mm-hmm. when Allègre talks in a public space, mm-hmm. okay, he is a scientist. He is from the academy. He has been there for quite a long time. He has a group of people with him in the academy and so on. Mm-hmm. You cannot say in the public space, he's not a scientist. He is.
Right, he belongs to the 0.5% who don't understand this part.
I fully agree with you, but when, I mean, the Anthropocene is just not the warming of the planet.
I think, for example,
that all the question of chemical products, you have many other questions which are central to us
absolutely.
In this process.
Absolutely.
And depending I'm not talking about the substance of science. Mm-hmm. I'm talking the way, concretely, mm-hmm. in context, scientists, as human beings. You say, mm-hmm. he's a politician. Fine. Mm-hmm. He was also mm-hmm. a politician. But, I mean, mm-hmm. we are also doing politics. I mean, my point is that in terms, in the public space, that if science, I mean by science, all scientists were speaking one way. Mm. That would make a difference. But in most of the cases, you always have some who says the contrary. So that,
but the media systematically, in some cases, try to create that image. And I think good journalism would be very much served if it was not just about portraying two opinions that are out there, but actually investigating whether one or the other has a somewhat higher likelihood. And I was trying to say it really depends on the question. In some, there's a high degree of uniformity of scientific opinion. And of course, this can all be toppled by new findings. It's not in all cases, but in other things, it's very uncertain. Like this big thing, is global intensification of agriculture more sustainable than less intensive extensification? Do you want to use more space or do you put other chemicals on small space? That's an open question, for example, and you can have very different opinions about that. So, I don't want to always go back to that one, the CO2 question, because indeed that's a small part of the Anthropocene, even though it's a very central part, because it really will determine a lot of things. It's just like one of the biggest frameworks you can have, just what is the climate of a region. But the limits are there everywhere. I mean, it's obvious.
No, it's my point is not just when we are talking now. It's more about what is a public space. A public space is not science talking to society. A public space is something complicated, very complicated. Mm-hmm. You have people with their own imaginaries, their own culture, if we use the vocabulary, their own tendencies. Mm-hmm. Some are more adventurous, some are more precautionous, So all the human beings are probably quite different. Okay? Then in that, it's structure. The public space is structure. Mm-hmm. Behind that, You have the media, but you have also political parties. You have many things which structure that. And it's very easy for people to play in the public space. I mean, you have experts of that, about advertisement and so on. They know how to play. Okay, so for we know...
But that's why I said I think it's a question of the relationship between, you know, of the position of science, of the scientific system in relation to the general culture that a nation or some people have. Because, you know, do they value the science system? Why do they even create it? Why do they even support it? And I think some unclarity has appeared. We have a lot of public funding for the science system. But the relationship between science and the public, I think, is somewhat broken. And that has to do with this issue of trust. So I would like to come back really to this question. What is the role of a society having scientists? You know, are they the keepers of specialized knowledge that nobody is supposed to understand and people should just trust them? Or is there sort of dialogue, or are they delegates? And I'd be interested in knowing, you know, how did that evolve in the tradition of the European Enlightenment, and where do we stand today when we plan public policies and try to re-engage the public into scientific findings?
Let me give you, just to show why I think your image is too simple and you cannot be efficient because it's too simple,
I'm a physicist,
Listen, one point. When you have pool of opinions, in France, for example, it's everywhere in Europe, but I know particularly the case in France.
Yeah.
If you ask people, you interview 1,000 people according to the standard norms of sociology and so on, the person who always gets between 90 and 95% of confidence, trust, is the scientist from the CNRS, okay?
Very true, yeah.
Good. That is absolutely stable. It has not changed over the last 40 years. We have that at least for 40 years, all the time. The last one in 2014, it's still at 93, 94. It goes up again. Okay? So, apparently, trust in science, you cannot say the contrary. Massively, the French population, the European population as a whole, is massively confident in science. That's the proof. The scientist, and the most abstract, the image of the scientist as an icon, is the people everybody trusts. First point. Second point, if you follow the people who most oppose concrete situation, who contest certain things, who are the most active in social movements vis-à-vis nuclear business, opposing that, against the pesticide, and in certain contexts, discussing a lot around climate change. The more they are educated in science, the more they are careful in what they want to say, which is normal. So it means the more you are educated, de facto, the more you tend to be skeptical, which is good and coherent, and it is scientific attitude. You see my point?
Yes.
So my point is, it's not just that you would have science and a society who is not confident. Society is largely confident in science if we define science as the icon, the quest for truth and objectively and so on, okay? The more you are educated as a scientist, the more critical you became. Fine, okay? That's my point. The point, so it's not just, you see, we have to understand that and historically, if we look at that, we see very well that I do not believe, for example, that people are becoming more critical now than 50 years ago. I think we have no reason to believe that. I'm not thinking they are becoming irrational, as many people said. No, they are becoming critical in a positive sense. But as soon as you have disagreement between the experts, how do you give your trust? which is a real question. And very often a small amount is enough.
Okay. Well, let me say two things. The first is I don't see this relationship between science and society and the trust that exists in the form that scientific knowledge and the way scientists express it should be accessible to public discourse. I think public discourse is a cultural stream of happenings, of cultural reproduction. And the question is, how do you integrate scientific findings into that cultural discourse, or how do you even create a resonance, if you don't integrate it because it's not possible, how do you create a resonance between topics discussed in science and topics produced out of culture? I mean, culture can produce systems of meaning, of interpretation, like it was in legends and myths and national identities and aspirations and all these things that are completely don't have any scientific basis to them. But I do think that in the European Enlightenment, things like claiming certain natural laws having to do with the liberty of the human mind or the equality of people have entered discourse. And in that sense, I feel that the question is, what is the cultural production we could have that could somehow create a resonance with scientific findings if we feel that there's a likelihood that some of the messages science tells us today, at least on some topics, that it would be worthwhile integrating them in the cultural reflection? Now, that's the first thing. So I don't think it's just like, listen to our facts and numbers. That's not how it works. Culture is primary, and science somehow has to is something that should then be incorporated into cultural expressions. And that's the only way, by the way, how I think that, I've been talking about the tradition of the Enlightenment in Europe, but how do we discuss with China, with the Islamic world, with India, with South America, with different cultural traditions? The only way is to kind of get a resonance between science and national cultures if we want to have a global dialogue about these things. The second thing I want to say is Alexander von Humboldt, who is a really excellent example, because after his travel he went to Paris because he felt the scientific and intellectual environment was much better there than in stiff and cold Berlin and Prussia. And then later, he was convinced to come to Berlin back, and he also had, spent the rest of his life here. But I think he always was dreaming of Paris a little bit. So it's a nice connection between Berlin and Paris in that sense. And he did both. He did the measurements. He went there and he did all the atmospheric measurements, the pressure measurements, the lists of animals, and he published them in Paris in huge volumes.
Yes.
But then at the same time, he worked on condensing them into what he called tableaus, assemblies of knowledge, where he selected certain things, where he emphasized certain aspects, and he tried to build an image of the system with words and actually also with painting, because he understood that the human mind needs to engage the systemic character, also the geological depth and the human intervention into things through aesthetic.
Yes, absolutely. The drawings are absolutely splendid. Yes,
and this is the same problem that we have today. How do you build a computer model? What parts do you put in? What you don't? And it's not the same as saying we have all these long lists of things and they all have to go in. The question is, what are the principles of selection? What is the representation? And how do you translate the outcomes into something of an aesthetic, of a cultural quality that actually can inform people in their cultural context about certain things that are more than just lists, but are actually integrated pictures of situations in the interpretation, in this case of Alexander von Humboldt, how he saw them as a scientist. So he was two-track, measurements, tables, and also these tableaus of systemic things. Yes, and I think that makes him special. And that's, I think, how the relationship between anthropocenic science and the cultural production of the Anthropocene, or the cultural discussion of the Anthropocene, needs to be organized. I think there's much that could be taken from Alexander von Humboldt particularly.
No, I agree with that. I do not doubt it. And I mean, it's important to find ways to express what we believe in accessible forms and material forms, all that are very important. Okay, I've no doubt. But my fundamental point is that it's not that people are not trusting science, is that people are experiencing certain difficulties with techno development. That's my main point. And there, it's not just a matter of drawing and having the right picture. It's more complicated than that.
Well, science of course, fiction is a big production.
We are in a kind of, I'm not at, I mean, in a way, in your case, with global warming or trying to establish that, I would say your case, understand your point. And yeah. It's unbearable to have people like Alec or the people who tries to destabilize your community with the East Anglia business, I mean, which is sheer unpleasant manipulation. But of course, we have many other things which are dealing with energy, which are dealing with chemistry, which are dealing with nuclear problem, and so on, where it's far more, what I'm saying, and that's what I know better, there the situation is profoundly different, because you might be very confident in the quality of chemistry, but you might also experience the effects. Mm-hmm. You could say, okay, nuclear physics is a great business, but you might say, okay, what do we do with the waste now? Of course, you could tell me we could withdraw them regularly, check, but it will never work.
But Alexander von Humboldt, he did not go to the Orinoco to then come up with the folk tales, but his program was actually to go there and prove certain connections between the things. Then he then injected into the public discussion in a very successful manner.
Yes, but the point is not, I mean, it's not a bit, the problem of the social and the public space is not a pedagogical problem. It's not a matter of explaining well. That is an element. It's not the end of the story. The core of the story is the experience of people with certain consequences and the fact that the expert, which are associated for most of the people with the scientists, disagree quite regularly, not at the same height for everything, but the fact that it's enough to have some. I mean, and that's largely the problem. I mean, it's the idea of the pedagogy is very important. We have to be pedagogical. And I mean, in my, I have no doubt with the IPCC result personally, and I always say that. But in as a question, it's more complicated than that. So we have to realize that you have a disjunction between science and techno-development, and that in most fields, many scientists try to explain that the techno-development is also science, and there you start to have trouble. When you say people are not confident in GMOs because they're irrational, you start to say that, and then the battle will be very difficult to win, because at that moment, at the moment someone says that, you cannot say, no, I mean, science is important.
And
you
so
see
since
my point. And that is very, very, very common.
So since we were asked to come to a conclusion of our of our exchange, I do think, in the beginning I said that I think, you know, the limits of knowledge allow for exciting expeditions to the limits of knowledge, and that this is as exciting as when in previous histories people went to the limits of the known world to see what is beyond. And of course there were people also living there, you know, they discovered new worlds, but people were already living there. So I do think that if you go on such a voyage of expedition, it would be good to bring along a scientist. I think it would also be good to bring along an artist. You need somebody who knows in practical things. Things, if your ship has a problem, then, you know, somebody who knows how to deal with things. And you probably need somebody who can write the history of the voyage. And so I think a certain mix of things. But a scientist should be on board. I think like Darwin's voyage or Alexander von Humboldt's voyages. And similarly today, I think, as we talk about the Anthropocene, several people must be on board. But if you throw off the scientist in the middle of the Atlantic because he says so dry stuff, then maybe you will never really come to good conclusions.
No, we should redo what the people did in 16th century up to the early 20th century. There were no expeditions apart from the first, very first one, without a scientist, without artist, without naturalist, without compass, without people studying the star, without bringing back specimen, bringing back, including human beings, we were considered specimens, and that was, they were exhibited in Paris, in London, in the great exhibitions and so on. So, yes, I agree. It has to be done this way. My only thing is that, having studied a lot, what is happening in the complexity of social world in which science is, it's not outside, it's in there. Completely, we cannot disentangle it. And the way people experience what other people call science, because For me, for you, probably. Science, we have an idea. Science with a big S, or science with a comma. I mean, science, we know, it's a kind of ideal. We know what it is. It's a procedure. Yeah, so it's a way of, but in the concrete setting. So that's why people ask, what is the people you trust most? Of course, it's the scientists.
Yeah, so I would just like to tell the public that there was an ice age only 15,000 years ago, and that you know, that in the since the beginning of humans as a species, the world has always been colder than today, or at most 2 degrees warmer. And so, if you make it 5 degrees warmer, we will certainly have a situation that has never been there in the archive of the Earth. And so, these are things that I think people will find interesting, and that have been very difficult to find out. And I think we can be quite confident that this is actually not a complete fantasy. And so, then we can just go back to the beginning of the discussion.
At least in Europe, for example, about global warming, I think if we were to ask people, a vast majority believes in it. Don't you think so?
No, it's being undermined, and it's at
who is undermining as a scientist?
Oh, we are being asked to stop. Okay, so this was a very interesting discussion. Thank you very much, Dominique.